There's slides and there's an outline, but it's not on the handout. And there's an explanation, and I thought I should just make it clear. What's happening is when Pastor Mark sent me the description, he said, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday school, preach in the morning, and then for the evening, service. I thought it said service. I haven't looked back at it. And I thought that I would be preaching. I thought we would have, service type thing, and that there would be a sermon type thing. And so I'd prepared a sermon type thing. And it wasn't on the handout. It wasn't part of the argument. It is still part of the argument, and now it's in PowerPoint form, not in sermonic form. So, and I'm happier with this than what I had planned. So this works out pretty well as far as I'm concerned. So here's where it fits in the argumentative flow of what I've been doing. We did, on Friday night, we did life and death in the Bible, life abundant. We started talking about death. On Saturday night, we talked about being servants of Jesus all the time in everything, including choices that we make about death. In Sunday school, we kept talking about what that means to make choices for your own parents. But in this case, I was making choices the way I knew my father had wanted them made. So I was really just carrying out his wishes. And now we need to look at what happens when you don't know what your parents want. Or they haven't left clear instructions, but you're still going to have to make choices without a document. The medical people, because of the law, are still going to go to you if their spouse is not alive or if the spouse is unwilling or unable to do it. They're going to come to you and they're going to ask. And so a big part of living out the fifth commandment to honor our father and mother includes the way we handle the choices that we have to make for them in the hospital, certainly, but there's lots of other choices that you have to make. So all those are, that's where we are. We're on making choices when the instructions aren't clear. And Jerry, when he was describing to me, he said, I'm getting it. That's your name. Dale. I'm very sorry. I knew who I was talking about. The other tall guy was Jerry. Dale, you can have a document, and it still not be clear what you're supposed to do. And so you're still going to have to think through between what they told me and what our relationship was like before things became not helpful, and this document, I have to make choices. So when you go in the scriptures and look for instructions about what it means to honor your parents and other older people, it turns out there's not a lot of verses. The fifth commandment is clear. Paul's treatment of the fifth commandment in Ephesians 6, where he says that it's the honor your father and mother, it's the first commandment with a promise that you will live long in the land that your God is giving you. He says that. This is the longest passage in the Bible about the way we show honor for our parents. So I'm going to read from Proverbs 6. My son, keep your father's commandment and forsake not your mother's teaching. Bind them on your heart always. Tie them around your neck. When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk with you. For the commandment is a lamp and the teaching a light, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life, to preserve you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Okay, this is clearly aimed at a son. Like, just go with me on this. The passage should be clearly an echo of Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6, starting at verse 4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And you will talk of the law when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you arise. So this is not the commandment of the Lord. This is the commandment of your mother and father, which Solomon in the Proverbs is saying, should be for you like the commandment of the Lord. That's a pretty big deal. And those of you that have children, like those of you who have children in the room, you should just take a moment and bow. Thank you. This is how you should. Joanna and Rebecca should be thinking about their father and mother's teachings kind of like the Ten Commandments. Kind of. Where it fits in Proverbs, so the first thing to notice, maybe not, I already gave you a first thing to notice. Here's a second thing to notice about this passage, and that is that it's in Proverbs 1 through 9. Proverbs 1 through 9 is a prologue to all of the individual, one verse at a time, aphorisms that come in Proverbs 10 through 30. Proverbs 31 goes back to a long set of instructions about the excellent woman, about but between 10 and 30, it's one verse at a time. There are a verse about taming the tongue, a verse about not being lazy, a verse about not trusting people who break the law in one way. So that's just boom, 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 boom. 1 through 9, though, is a long parallel description. It describes two women. Wisdom, the woman who stands in the middle of the street in broad daylight and says, "Come to me, I am the way." And to pick up what we were talking about in the sermon this morning, Proverbs 8, wisdom makes three claims for herself. The beginning of Proverbs 8 is, "I am the way. All of those who walk in my way find peace." Middle of it is, "I am the truth." And the last third of Proverbs 8 is, "I am the life." So when Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," he's saying, "I am the Lady Wisdom," from Proverbs 8. And she's the fulfillment. She is the embodiment of the law, and her counterpart in Proverbs 1 through 9 is the adulteress, the woman who stands not in the middle of the street, but out in the alleyway in the dark going, "Psst, hey buddy, my husband's not at home. He's gone on a long journey. Come on, it'll be great." And this is the contrast between wisdom and rebellion in Proverbs. Here, right in the middle of it, is pay attention to your parents. Obey your parents' teaching. They are the antidote to the evil woman with the smooth tongue. So, if you're wondering how you should think about your parents' instructions, it's the way of life. Leviticus 19. Here we have the only clear verse in the Bible. There are other allusions to the gray heads and to wisdom being associated with the old, but Leviticus 19 says directly, "You shall stand up before the gray head and honor the face of an old man, and you shall fear your God. I am the Lord." Leviticus 19 is a whole series of be this way, don't be this way, I am the Lord. They all end with, "I am the Lord." And so the reason God gives for obeying this command is, it's because who I am. This is what it means to be living my way. I am the Lord. So we will not point out gray hairs here, but if you lack gray hairs, you should stand up for gray hairs. This is common knowledge in almost all cultures ever, and in most of the world to this day, until just the last, well, since the 1960s, that the wisdom in a culture is found in the oldest among you, however old that happens to be. So this wouldn't have been shocking to the Israelites or anybody around the Israelites, but it is surprising to us. And that's going to end up mattering. So here's our first question. What does it mean to honor our parents and other seniors? The reason this is difficult is you might wonder, are we required to obey our parents even after we are grown up? My mother is still alive. My mother's 83. My mother is full of life, even with a broken back that has her in a back brace for the next 8 weeks. She is full of life. Now, my mother does not command me to do anything. But suppose she did. Suppose she said, I've heard that your youngest son is acting the fool by being a computer science major. Go and punish him for being a computer science major. But I have an obligation to go to say, oh, it's my mother. I have to obey her. Is that how it works? I'm pretty sure most of you are thinking, no, and does she do that sort of thing? No, my mother doesn't. There are parents who do with their 50-something-year-old children, give them, lay down the law. So are you breaking the fifth commandment when you don't obey your parents? What about when your parents become like children themselves? They have to be, you have to take the car keys away from them. Something that you would do with a teen who was not doing safe things with the car. Can you do that? Can you take the car keys away from your parents? What about if you have to feed them and change their diapers? Do they become children again? In which case they should obey you. Is that how it works? Is the relationship between, do we honor our parents because they do for us what parents do for children, and when they've stopped doing those things for us, we no longer have an obligation to honor them? I hope you know the answer to that is no. They don't become like our own children, but why not? And then how do we make decisions for our parents? Here's how it ties with the rest of what we've been talking about this weekend. When our parents can't make them themselves, how do we go about making those choices? And do all senior citizens deserve honor? There's no question that the Bible makes it clear that your parents deserve honor, but do all senior citizens deserve honor? If you're a senior citizen, you're hoping that the answer to that is yes. hey, wait a minute. So if you're a senior citizen and have no children or living children of your own, does it mean you're just out of luck? I'm sure you're confident, as I am, that the answer is that we owe honor to all those who are older. Leviticus 19 says so. Though this is, I'm not going to go into it now, but I'm going to offer this as something for you to pursue on your own, just for the sake of time. I said discouraging things about the larger catechism last time, about the larger catechism questions 136, not like two times ago. That I think that they, when they say that it's a sin to neglect or withdraw the necessary means of preserving your life, that they were writing in the 1600s and they were not thinking of ventilators and CPR, and we know they weren't. Now I'm going to say something really positive about the larger catechism, and if you have never opened the larger catechism, here's a good excuse. Question and answer 124 and following are about the fifth commandment. And with most of the commandments, there are just three questions. There's a question, what is the fifth commandment? Honor your father and mother. And then for most of the commandments, there's two others. There's one commandment that says, what are the duties required of this commandment? And what are the sins forbidden for this commandment? And so usually there's three, and then you go on to the next commandment. But for the fifth commandment, there are nine. The first one is, what is the fifth commandment? And then it says, why are those in authority styled as father and mother? And it goes on to explain that the fifth commandment extends to those in authority over you, whether bosses or political figures, those in actual political authority. So it says it's about a hierarchy of what it calls superiors, equals, and inferiors. Now, this is not inferior beings or superior beings. And then it's a whole series of questions. What are the duties of superiors to their earthly inferiors? Bosses to employees, mayors to the town. They've got all this in mind. And then the duties, and then what are the sins that superiors can commit against their inferiors? And they say, what are the duties of inferiors to superiors? What are the sins that inferiors commit? One of the big ones in all of these is failure to pray for those above them or below them. Failure to extol their virtues, make a big deal of highlighting the ways they're excellent and protecting, covering over, and bearing with their weaknesses. And then there's questions and answers about how you treat your equals. I find it highly edifying. So Dean was talking about where his Sunday school series left off in Colossians, and they were about to get into all the practical stuff, including masters and slaves, and larger catechism questions 124 and following would be a gold mine for that discussion. So we have a case. This is based on a real case with all the names changed. Well, yeah, most of them, yeah. The names changed that I dealt with recently. So Edith is a 91, and I realize that you don't have it in front of you, so I'm going to read it, and you can ask questions about how this works. Edith is a 91-year-old believer whose husband died 7 years ago. Edith fell and broke her hip 2 months ago. Before she broke her hip, she had moved into a modest assisted living facility that she could afford out of her savings. Her grandson, Hutch, is a local pastor. He visited her 4 times a week, often bringing his children. After the hip surgery, Edith became confused and tried to walk to dinner. She fell. She re-injured her hip. I wish I could tell you that this was super uncommon. This is a very common story. The doctors say if she falls again, it could be fatal, that just the pain could kill her. She can't afford a full-time sitter to watch her. She can afford to live in the assisted living facility. She can't afford to pay somebody to watch her all the time to keep her from getting up when she gets confused and trying to walk somewhere. And the facility is not allowed, legally not allowed, to restrain her. They can't tie her to the chair because, well, you're not supposed to do that. She would have to be in the hospital for somebody to write an order to restrain her. Her grandson wants to know if honoring his grandmother means draining his own savings to pay for a full-time sitter. He asked her, but she can't understand the question. Okay? And so, for this particular case, he wanted to talk to me about what the fifth commandment requires of him. So you should imagine that you're sitting in Starbucks hearing this story. And Hutch wants an answer. Like, what do I do? I'm curious. What do you think? I know I've been just yammering away like none of you have any responsibility, but what do you think? Marty? Okay, right. So one thing is marshal an army to come sit with her. Right. Now, so he's the pastor. It's a little church. Not tragically little. It's like the size of this church. Would this work? I'll ask the pastor. This is a mean question. I'm not going to ask the pastor. That would be hard to, not that it would be impossible, but this would be a difficult thing to do, to cover all 24 hours a day in the facility, even for the church. And that would be a great place to start. But you'd have to cover all 24 hours. You could say maybe put her to sleep, put a monitor on the bed, so that when the monitor goes off, somebody from the facility would run and keep her from getting out of bed, something like that. Dean?
Mm-hmm. She's now near to the need of that herself. There's no person to replace her, sort of.
Right. She certainly can't do it for herself.
No.
Well, we will come back to this. Because we have to develop some principles. But there's a way to... So here are the questions that we will come back to. Is he obligated? If he doesn't hire a sitter, will he be responsible if she falls and dies? That's how he put the question at the beginning. If I don't hire a sitter, and then how should he make the decision? We'll talk about that in a minute. We discussed. So let's talk about honoring our parents when we're children. When we're children, and I mean little children, not Rebecca-sized children. I don't know. We'll have to think about this one. When we're six, we honor our parents by obeying them. And so when they say, don't open the oven when it's on, and we open the oven when it's on, they remind us how wrong that is with supplemental pain. We will not go into the details of how the pain is supplemented. We will just say that in addition to the pain that comes from opening the oven itself, the shock of the blast of heat and all that, there is supplemental pain to make sure that the lesson is remembered. Now, even when you're six, if your parents say, steal that roast, stuff it in your pants while we leave the store, even a six-year-old can say, I'm really sure I'm not supposed to do that, because we're only obligated to obey their lawful commands that is not obviously inconsistent with the Bible. So, now, we really don't want eight-year-olds questioning every command their parents give and say, I'd need chapter and verse on that. Like, you just told me to go to bed at 11 o'clock and I don't see it in the Bible. That's not how it works. It has to be obviously inconsistent with the Bible. But as you get older, you start asking your parents to give you reasons. Not just I said so, but reasons. And that's, up to a point, appropriate. It can be excessive. So one thing we do is we obey. I hope you've noticed that when you bring a child home from the hospital, there is no instruction manual. I remember looking for the instruction manual, like, what do we do now? Like, wait for him to yell, and then do one of the three things that might be the reason he's yelling. Might be hungry, might have a messy diaper, might just be cranky, and then there's nothing you can do about that one. But I would like the manual to continue, not just what to do when they're very tiny, but what to do when they're 14, and they've got pretty good reasons for disagreeing with you. I would like to be like a chart. When they disagree about this, ground them. When they disagree about this, let them have their way quietly. Because they're learning independence. But there was none of that. So there is a transition here. I'm going to go from 6 to 26 with skipping all of the hard stuff in between, where you gradually hand off. That's very difficult. But the other thing we do is we make them proud. In the righteous sense, not in the unrighteous sense. We don't make them sinfully proud. But we advance their righteous plans. We help them load the car to go to the beach for vacation. Okay, that one they don't mind doing because they agree with the plans. But we help them clean the house when people are coming to view the house because you want to sell it. And they don't want to help. They don't want to leave the house at all. They like this house. They don't want it to sell. And yet they help clean the house because the parents have righteous plans, and so they're advancing the righteous plans. And then also children protect their parents' reputation. The clearest example of that in the Bible is when after the flood, Noah acts the fool. He gets drunk. Something happens about exposing himself. His sons see what's happening, and Ham thinks it's funny and mocks his dad, and Shem and Japheth walk in backwards and cover him with a cloak, and they cover over what is unseemly about their dad. And the blessing that comes after that in Genesis 8 and 9 is really big, because Shem and Japheth protected Noah's reputation, his honor, even when he'd gotten in that position from getting drunk. So I think that's part of what children do. is they make their parents proud, partly by protecting their reputation and covering over. So when you teach first grade Sunday school, nobody prepared me for this part. When it's time for prayer requests, sometimes children tell you the bad things their parents are doing. I'd like prayer because my dad hits my mom. Now, this has only happened once in 15 years, but that's not fun. That's a, you know, is that a mandatory report? No, my dad hits my sister. Yes, I report that. My dad hits my mom. So you want children. So you don't want the children to be telling falsehoods about their parents, but you want their parents, you want the children saying happy things about their parents' virtues and not spreading around stories about their parents' failings. And probably if it's ever happened that your children have told other people about your bad behavior, so this is the other thing you get. The other day in the grocery store, my dad ate an entire thing of grapes and didn't pay for it. This is during Sunday school. He picked up the bag, put it in the cart. They were all gone before we got to the cash register. What do you say to this kid? And then the kid says, he was breaking the 8th commandment, wasn't he? Let's talk about times when you've broken the 8th commandment. Not going there. Not going to help you trash your parents. So, but when we're adults, so now we're going to talk about how we translate what it means for children to honor their parents to how we honor our parents when we're adults. Now we've gone from 6 to 26. Obedience, and the Bible attests to this, and especially the book of Proverbs. There are 6 times in the book of Proverbs where Solomon directly says, this is what it means to be a faithful a wise young man or a wise man, is that you pay careful attention to what your parents tell you. And it's not just for children. It's a wise man finds out what his parents think about what he's about to do. So we listen carefully. We seek their advice. We act on their wise counsel even when it means admitting they know something. Again, this is not the same thing as being required to obey them. It means that God has provided them as a resource. The Bible's pretty clear that your parents are given as a gift. Now, it's not all parents. There are foolish parents. But there's an expectation that your parents are a source of blessing because of their experience and their love for you. They will apply their experience for your good. And the implication in the Bible is that when you are no longer a child and you're an adult, the way it's going to work is, instead of you waiting for them to tell you what to do, you're going to go ask them. Now, I can't tell you that I have nothing like a perfect record on this. When I have important decisions to make, I'm not calling my mother. And part of the reason I'm not calling my mother is she's going to have an opinion. And when she has an opinion and I don't agree, which I expect is going to happen, then it's going to be a moderate crisis for me. And I'd rather just not know. So my mother hears about my important decisions after it's too late. Which I don't think is, like, I am not a person to tell you, be like me in this regard. But I think this is what it means when we're adults. When it comes to making them proud, instead of working to do things, well, we still work to advance their righteous projects. We encourage the faithful use of their continuing powers. I made reference to, I'm trying to remember which talk, but I made reference to Amy Sherman's book, Kingdom Calling. That book is, the last third of the book is a description of it's this, like all of us, seniors have more power than they realize. The third section of Amy Sherman's book is really, the title of it should be, You Have Way More Power Than You Realize. Whether you're 12 years old or 82 years old, you have more power. And she has seven different ways that you have power. This is not all of them. Wealth is only one of them. You've got time, you've got networks, you've got skills, you've got reputations, you have knowledge, you have a platform. She's got seven. And then there's sections of the chapter that give specific examples of what it means to have that kind of power. So that's the first half of part three of the book. The second half of part three is, what are we going to do with this power? Now that you've done and given, you know, you've identified and made an inventory of the power that you have, what do you do with it? You do what Jesus did with it. You give it away. That's the message of the book. Jesus had all the power in the universe, and he set it all aside. He gave it all away for us. They have, among the powers that are easily overlooked is prayer. I had this brought home to me forcefully, the senior pastor, well, no, the former senior pastor of our church as of October 1st. His greatest delight as a minister of the gospel is visiting people who can't leave their houses. That's his favorite thing to do. He's a good preacher. This is Joe Novenson. You may have heard him at General Assembly. He's a good preacher. What he's fantastic at is going into the homes of people who just are too sick to leave and bringing them encouragement, bringing them communion. One of the best things about being an elder in this church is I get to go with him to administer communion to people who can never leave their homes. And there was a group of people who were shut-ins in this sense, and they had a common anxiety. They said, what am I supposed to do? I'm alive, I'm awake, I'm not physically strong enough to leave my house, but I can still think clearly. What am I supposed to do? And he said, you can pray. And he got permission. We have, as is fairly common, we have marriages in our church that are in trouble. And Joe knew who these people were. And he got permission from some of them, from the husband and wife whose marriage was struggling, he got permission to have four of these shut-ins pray for them every day. And then he would go and report. When he would go to visit them, he would say, here's what I learned the last time I talked to the people that you were praying for. And your prayers, sometimes he can say, your prayers are part of how God restored their marriage. You sat in this house and your prayers were part of how God saved their marriage. They had something to do. They weren't well enough to leave their house, but they could do something powerful. And I think probably when Satan looks out over a whole bunch of believers and they look powerful the way they look powerful to him, he sees a philosopher and thinks, okay, that's a little boy with no weapons. And he sees an older person who's not physically strong enough to leave the house but is praying every day and sees a dangerous warrior. I think that's how the world looks to Satan. I look like nothing, and people who are committed to prayer, they look dangerous. I don't think we see people the way the angels and demons see people. Because we think of prayer as something you do when you've run out of other options rather than the first and most powerful thing that we would do. So we can encourage this. We can be cheerleaders for our parents. Cheerleaders for them to be active in prayer. Cheerleaders for them to be ministering in ways that they are still able with the experience and the wisdom that they have. Cheerleaders for righteousness in industry, because they're also servants of Jesus. We're a bunch of servants doing what Jesus wants, and we should be cheering each other to love and good deeds. But now we're going to talk about what happens when we're going to choose for them. They're not able to make the choice. The situation with Edith and her grandson, she can't make the choice anymore. She can't understand the question. So he's going to have to make a choice for her. And this is the formula. We make the choices they would make if they could understand the questions and express their values. This takes some investment. It means that you need to start asking them now, while they can still answer your questions, what they would want. And then we're going to choose according to their values, not our own. So long as what their values would lead to are biblically appropriate, we make those choices, even though they're not our choices. So that's the formula. Because you were raised by your parents, your values are probably pretty similar to theirs already. But you shouldn't just assume it. You should talk to them while they can still answer your questions. So here's another case. I'm going to come back to Edith. We'll get there. This one is relatively simple and ridiculously common. Marvin is a 70-year-old believer who is unconscious in the ICU on a respirator and unlikely to regain consciousness. He's a widower, and his only child, Peggy, has not been in contact with her father for almost 20 years. That's not happy. That's a bad thing. Marvin did not leave an advance directive, but more than once he told his friends that he would, quote, hate to be kept alive by machines. The medical team is looking to Peggy, as they would, to authorize a DNR order, a do not resuscitate order. When the physician, when you say yes to one of these, if their heart stops beating, then there won't be an attempt to bring them back. And here's my rough rule. If you trust the doctors and they ask you for a DNR, say yes. Because I don't know any doctors that make inappropriate requests for these. When I was teaching at Mount Union, I also volunteered at a hospital. It's now very close to here, Alliance Community Hospital, and I have no idea what's happened in that hospital in the 25 years since I was on that committee. When I was there, it was about as dysfunctional as a committee can be. It was run by lawyers. They were there to rubber stamp whatever would maximize profit for the hospital. It was bad. I hope it's better. I don't know. I haven't kept up. Please do not tell people at Alliance Community Hospital that I was dishing dirt. I'm dishing dirt on them 25 years ago. Even there, I would trust the doctors if they said, we really think that an attempt to resuscitate your father would not accomplish anything significant. I would have said, yeah, the doctors are not asking. You have to have a really good reason to believe that the doctors are frauds. Usually when they make this request, they've thought about it really hard. I don't know, Marty, you were close to a doctor. Is that your sense that, yeah, doctors know that this is a grave thing to ask for, and well, so in this case, they're asking Peggy if she will say yes to a do not resuscitate order. And Peggy knows from Marvin's friends what Marvin said. He said, I don't want to be kept alive on machines. He's currently being kept alive on machines. She has every reason to believe he doesn't want to be here. And she says, no, because she has neglected her dad long enough. She'll fight for him now. This happens. I'm pretty sure that we could go to the closest hospital here that has an ICU, and there'd be somebody in there where this was happening. This is the most common thing that happens in the hospital. Children who feel guilty about neglecting their parents show up when the parents can no longer make choices, and they make the choices that the children want, not what the parents would want. And this, I think, is not honoring your parents. Yeah, I was going to think discussion, but I've made that impossible by telling you what I think. Sorry. I should have delivered it in a flat monotone and asked you what you thought. But I didn't. Okay, we're good. Very briefly, this is not surprising. Honoring parents and seniors is currently countercultural. Our culture values productivity, entertainment, youthful vitality. And because of that, careful attention to older people is thought of as a kind of waste of time. There's something sad about devoting your time to people who are no longer contributing to what is fun and productive. So what this means is that if we are going to honor parents and seniors, we're going to have to swim against the current of the culture that we're in. So steps to swim upstream against our culture. I find this to be a helpful image. I use this with my college students. Say, the culture is moving. The culture is not standing still. The culture is going somewhere. And right now, it wasn't going in as completely wrong a direction 50 years ago as it is now. But right now, it's going the wrong direction. So if you think you're just standing still and you're moving with the current, you're going backwards, spiritually at least. So you have to, it's going to seem like a ton of work to keep, just not to lose ground. And if you don't know that the culture is moving, you're going to think that you're making all kinds of progress when all you're doing is standing still or possibly slipping. So we have to work, to fight, to swim upstream, which means we need to pray. We need to pray that we would have a kind of zeal for the honor of our parents and other older people. So pray with them and to pray as a task for you and for them. When you have the opportunity to teach, you're leading a Bible study. You say, we should spend some time talking about the wisdom of old people. And try this on a college campus in a student Bible study. Let's talk about how great it is that there are older people around us with experience. And I'm like, what? But you could. And probably, once you get them started, they would realize that their grandparents know a ton. And they have stories to tell. And wow. So, teach about the wisdom of older people. Now, this is not to say that all old people are wise. Some of you know some old people. And they're occasionally not wise. So this isn't a blanket. All decisions made by older people are wise things. But there's an expectation in the scriptures that what they say is wise. There's a lot packed in this sentence. Assemble and resource multi-generational teams for service. Let me slow that. I just wanted to say it in a short way on the slide, and then I'll say it the long way now. There's a pretty serious threat, I think, confirmed by my seminary students, half of whom are youth pastors, that the church will split this way, generationally. It'll split into churches that are just older people who aren't willing to try anything new and insist on doing it their way because they're in charge, thank you very much, and younger people who would like to try all kinds of new stuff, some of them a good idea, some of them not, and rather than waiting their turn, they just go and form churches made up entirely of young people. And this is happening. So this is not good. It's not good for the witness of the church. If nothing else, it's bad for these groups of believers because they're both losing something important. The younger ones are losing the wisdom of the old, and the older ones are losing the vitality and just sheer mayhem capability of the young. And there's something really fun about having young, crazy people around. So, but they both have to think that their job is to reach out to the other rather than digging in their heels and being themselves. That's the hard part, is opening yourself up and letting the other run something. As with all efforts to reconcile believers, if you make the focus of what you're doing being reconciled, all it'll do all the time is remind people, oh, wait, we're divided. So if instead of focusing on the gap, you find something that you can both do together, there's something that we need to accomplish for the sake of the gospel, let's all go do this together. It's how you bring ethnic groups together, instead of focusing on ethnic differences, you focus on something that needs to be accomplished in your community. And then one day you wake up and say, wait a minute, we've been working alongside people who don't look like us or have the same kind of clothes and food, but we were all involved in this. That's the same thing needs to happen multi-generationally. And for a church like this, it might mean something pretty uncomfortable, like asking Joanna to go get her friends and let them tell you how to do something that would help the campus. Like, actually let them tell you. Not let them bring people that you will then fix. I don't know. That will work against the culture's expectation that older people and younger people cannot work together, because that's the expectation. And then listen more carefully and more often. Not just to their stories, not just to the stories of older people, but to their aspirations. What do they still hope for? What do they regret? What do they find delightful? In what do they find joy even now? But it means you have to get them talking. You can do that the other direction too. The older people can ask the younger people, what are you looking forward to? What's the funnest thing you do? And when they say, play Fortnite for 16 straight hours, you should not say, we're doomed as a culture. Like, you can think it, but don't say it. You could also go play some Fortnite and find out. It really messes up my college students when I'm in the middle of a lecture and I turn and I say, you know, if I beat on this wall, I would gather some stone, which I will need later. What are you? You playing Fortnite? I was watching some Fortnite. Wait, you're old. That's not possible. The title of this series was The Last Enemy to be Defeated. And before we go, because the last enemy to be defeated is death, before I wrap this up, I need to go back to the case of Edith and whether her grandson is obligated to spend his savings to provide a sitter for her. So this is the recommendation that I gave him. I said, your job is to make the choice that she would make if she could understand the question and express her values. Now, if she could understand, what would she choose? Would she want you to spend your savings to provide her with a sitter? He said, no way. There's no way she'd want that. She'd be horrified at the idea that I was depriving my family. That's not what she would want. That's the last thing she would want. Okay, well then, I think probably you shouldn't make that choice. You shouldn't make the choice that you know your grandmother would regret if you made it. You're choosing for her, and that's not what she would choose for herself. What do you suppose she would do if she would want me to find something that she could afford, and then if she fell and died, that'd be okay with her. And he said, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what she'd pick. I said, well, what could she afford? Well, there's an option at the nursing home to have somebody to put a monitor on her chair so that when she gets out of the chair, an alarm goes off at the nurse's station and somebody would come running. They might come too late because it's, you know, down the hall and around the corner. She might be already on the floor, but maybe if she got out of the chair and was, you know, still holding on to it and looking around, somebody would come in and say, you need to sit down now. Your hip is still healing. Said, so the cost for that service is very, very tiny. She can afford that. I said, do you think that's what she would pick if she could understand the question? I said, I'm pretty sure that's what she'd pick, but I still feel like I'm abandoning her. I said, your job is to pick what she would pick. And if that's what she would choose, if she understood all of the considerations here, then that's what it means to honor her. It doesn't mean that you do everything that she would need if she were your child. If she were your child, probably you're spending your savings to provide what she needs. She's not your child, she's your mother. Make the choice that she would make. And that's what they did. And she's still alive. That was four months ago, and she's still alive, which is good. Because that has been enough of a warning. And it's also that every attendant that walks past her room looks in and says, yep, she's still in the chair. And her hip is getting to the place where she probably could walk again. She's gotten past it. But the principles help make the choice that she would choose. The last enemy defeated is death. In Isaiah 25, I want to look at these passages as we run out of time. In Isaiah 25, Isaiah mocks death, and it's just too much fun not to share. So this is page 586. I've learned from reading the thing, if it's not in red, it's pages in the Bible.
You may be the first person.
But you take the time to put them up there. I've watched you do it. That's what they mean. The heading over Isaiah 25 in the ESV is God will swallow up death forever. And in 6 through 8, well, in this passage, there's a number of standard images for death, swallowing and veiling. And it's the swallower will be swallowed, the veil will be veiled, and the destroyer will be destroyed. Yeah, take that, Satan. Verses 6 through 8. On the mountain of the Lord of hosts, on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow and aged wine well refined. And he will swallow up this mountain, the covering, the veil that is veiled over all the people, the veil that is spread over all the nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth. And we know that the one who accomplishes that is Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul mocks death. It follows Isaiah. I tell you this, brothers, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. For this perishable body must put on the imperishable, and this mortal body must put on immortality. When the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on the immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Death is ended. We can show that death is ended by the way we care for each other. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for delivering us from death ultimately. And we ask that you would return before we taste physical death. But even if you tarry, we thank you that the death that we feel in the body is but a prick, and that the great victory that we have in Christ will go on forever and ever. We ask that you would make us agents, lights, and foretastes of that victory in all that we do and in what we show the world. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.